This morning I'm going to preach from the first of the signs of John's Gospel, the wedding at Cana. And as I was preparing this message, I was trying to think of what would it have been like to have been there, to have seen the things that were seen and to hear them. Why did people act in the way that they did? And so to help us all reflect on that this morning, I'm going to preach this message in a slightly different way. I'm going to do what's called a narrative sermon. If you've never heard what a narrative is, it's basically I'm going to step into the shoes of one of the main characters and speak as if I'm speaking from their perspective. So I'm going to give their view of everything that happened on this day. It's a little bit different to normal, but hopefully it'll all make sense when I begin in just a minute. But let me just pray before we start. Lord God, I thank you that you sent your Son into the world. I thank you that you also sent John to record the things that Jesus did and that he said, and that we have an accurate representation and recording of his life. I pray that you help us to see the signs that John gives about who Jesus is and what he came to do, but that we don't just notice these things or observe them, but they draw us more closely to yourself, that we would see you for who you are and want to know you, and especially be willing to turn to you in our time of need. Amen. All right. There are some days that you just don't forget, aren't there? Days that whenever you remember them, they bring a smile to your face because they were days that were full of joy. Maybe the birth of a child. Maybe the passing of some difficult exam. Maybe moving into a new house. Maybe even the day of your retirement. The day that sticks out for me is one of the days from my wedding. I say one of the days from, because here in ancient rural Israel, weddings could go on for as long as a week. And there were huge celebrations where the whole town was invited. And not just your town, but all of the surrounding towns as well. They say that weddings get more and more expensive every year. Maybe you can relate to that recently in your own experience. But can you imagine a week-long wedding with this many people? And all of that financial cost rested on one person's shoulders. Mine, the groom. Just to marry my bride, I had to save up for a very, very long time. Some of my friends saved up for 7 years just so they could marry their bride. But of course it would be worth it. It would be a great day and a great time of celebration. A time full of joy. But even before the celebration began, I had a nagging feeling in the pit of my stomach. You see, I knew something that nobody else knew. I knew that there might not be enough wine to last the entire celebration. And that might not sound like a big deal to you, but in our culture, in my culture, where it's full of shame and honour, this would be a complete disgrace. Just imagine if you were to turn up to a wedding and you were sitting down to the main meal and you had your utensils ready and you were about to dive in, but what you got served was one crusty bread roll and that was it. That's all you got. No matter what happened the rest of the whole celebration, that would be all you'd remember. No matter how beautiful the singing was at the ceremony, no matter how amazing the bride, the groom, the bridesmaids or the groomsmen looked, that crusty bread would be all that anyone would remember. And far, far worse than that, the only thing anyone would remember from my wedding, if the wine ran out, was that the wine ran out, and that would be it. It would be a complete disgrace and a complete disaster. Like, if I couldn't even provide for my wife on our wedding day, how would I be able to provide for her for the rest of our lives? This, the biggest celebration of our lives, would turn into the biggest disgrace of our lives. And everyone knows that the wedding is even more about the bride than the groom. This big celebration of her life would turn to tears. All her friends would probably break down and start crying at her misfortune, at marrying someone who couldn't provide for her. Certainly the gossipers would be out in force. They always are in these situations. I always knew she was too good for him. She could have done far better for herself, couldn't she? I wouldn't get much sympathy from her family either, because I would have brought disgrace and shame upon them as well. And in fact, in our community, some of the families had actually brought a lawsuit against the groom for such a situation just like this. And any future business transaction I entered, it would be tarnished. If I couldn't make good, at my own wedding, how could I be trusted to make good on what I promised to buy or sell in a business deal? I'd be cast out. You see, I could see all this coming, but there was absolutely nothing I could do to stop it. Every so often I would wander over to the servants and have a check. How much wine is there left? And every time there was less and less and less than I'd hoped. And I knew before long that the wine was going to run out. We were never going to have enough to last the whole celebration. In fact, I remember the exact moment I knew that the tap had run dry. I could see all the servants. They began to huddle together and they were whispering among themselves. And I could tell that they had pity on me and they felt sorry for me. And none of them had the courage to come and tell me what had happened. But it was obvious that the wine had run out. As well as the public disgrace of this wine running out, wine was also deeply symbolic to me as a Jew. You see, to the Jewish mind, wine symbolizes joy. In fact, our religious teachers at the time, the rabbis, they had a saying, without food and wine, there is no joy. This precious time of life, which should be filled with everything good, and the joy had run out. Maybe this was a bad omen. Maybe this is an omen that the couple whose wine ran out is the couple whose joy ran out. Maybe the couple without wine were going to be a couple without joy. Not an ideal way to start married life, is it? But I know I am not completely unique in my experience, am I? Everyone has times when the wine runs out in their lives. What do you do when the wine runs out? When joy turns to sorrow? Maybe like me, you had an experience that you could see coming. Maybe there was a sickness where it got worse and worse and worse, and there was nothing you could do to prevent it. You could see it in the distance, but here it was upon you. Or maybe you have a loved one. Or maybe there's a financial situation you're in or have been in. Started off small, but it's got worse and worse and worse. Or there's a sin in your life that has grown deeper and deeper, and it's strangling the joy out of your life and sucking it all out. What do you do when the joy runs dry in your life? Who do you turn to? Where do you go? Or maybe it just happened out of the blue. Maybe everything was going fine and there was lots of joy. And then all of a sudden it was all taken away from you. An immediate redundancy or a precious relationship that was shattered. Promises that were broken. A sudden trauma or something else that you just did not see coming. What do you do when the wine runs out in your life? Who do you turn to? There was a time in my people's past, as our Hebrew history, where our people were in a very similar situation to this, where a foreign country had come and destroyed everything, destroyed all of our cities, all of our towns, all of our armies, all of our crops, all of our vineyards. There was no wine and there was no joy. And in this desperate time, God sent a prophet named Jeremiah to encourage the people. He said that this isn't how it's going to be forever. One day things will change, and I will change them. And I've been considering this as it relates to my current situation now. So let me just read to you what God said to encourage the people through Jeremiah. God says, they will come, and they will shout for joy on the heights of Zion. They will rejoice in the bounty of the Lord, the grain, the new wine, and the olive oil, the young of the flocks and herds. They will be like a well-watered garden, and they will sorrow no more. Then the young woman will dance and be glad, young men and old as well. I will turn their mourning into gladness. I will give them comfort and joy instead of sorrow. I will satisfy the priests with abundance, and my people will be filled with my bounty, declares the Lord. Have you ever done that? Have you ever read a promise of God and wondered, when will that ever happen? Where was this God that I've read so much about? Where was this God that you read so much about if you read his word? Where was he to help our country in its current state? And where was he to help me with my current problems? When would there be this comfort and joy, this dancing and gladness, this grain, this olive oil, and this new wine? When would God come and fulfill the promises that he made? If only God were here and would do something. In fact, many people believed that maybe God was here again, and maybe he was about to do something. You see, a radical preacher had appeared, and there were exciting times that the promises of old were beginning to be fulfilled. He came dressed in camel's hair and lived out in the desert in Judea. He was causing a stir by calling the people to turn back to God and to get ready for the coming kingdom and the promised Messiah. Thousands of people had flocked to him, and to show their repentance, they had been immersed in water in the River Jordan, and this man was being nicknamed John the Baptizer. Was he God's promised prophet? Was this God's promised time? As I considered these things, it didn't seem to relate exactly to my current problem. What was I going to do about the wine in my situation, even if God was here? But as I considered, what do I do next? I saw a woman with some of the catering responsibilities. She started talking to the servants who were still whispering amongst themselves. It was Mary, the wife of Joseph, the carpenter from Nazareth. Nazareth was a village about 10 miles away from where the wedding was taking place in Cana. And so their family was known to our family, and so we had invited them to come and celebrate with us. Mary's oldest son was a man called Jesus, and rumor had it that he recently left the family's carpentry business and instead gone off to become a teacher of God, called a rabbi. Apparently, he was actually a close relative of this John the Baptizer, and had gone to him and been baptized himself in the River Jordan. And since then, in the last 3 days, he had begun collecting disciples, as the rabbis did at this time. One of his first disciples was a man I knew very well, a man called Nathanael, because he was also from the village of Cana. As I watched Mary, I could see that she understood what the problem was, and that the wine had run out. And I just caught her eye for a moment, and I saw the sadness and the compassion and the kindness that she had for my situation. She clearly wanted to help and to show us some kind of assistance. But for some reason, she wandered over to Jesus rather than coming to me. She started speaking to him. What did she expect Jesus to do in this situation? Whether as a carpenter or as a rabbi, what use is Jesus in my time of need? From what I could see, I'm not sure Jesus himself knew how he could help, because he seemed almost dismissive of Mary. It was like he had a different agenda. Maybe this was something to do with him becoming a rabbi and prioritizing the work of God. Clearly she believed Jesus would do something, though, because she went back to the servants and pointed Jesus out to them and almost told them to follow whatever he told them to do. And sure enough, shortly after, Jesus did go over to the servants and did start speaking to them. And he pointed to the 6 stone water jars nearby, and he gave instructions to the servants about them. At first, the servants didn't seem to understand what he was saying. Or maybe they just didn't understand why he was saying it, because they kept looking at the 6 jars and then pointing to where the fresh water came from. Then they began filling up these jars with fresh water. Each jar holds between 80 and 125 litres of water. So taken together, the jars hold between 480 and 750 litres. This here is a 5-litre bottle of water. This is just 5 litres. So it would take between 100 and 150 of these to fill the stone jars. Imagine 100 of these or 150 of these across the stage. That's how much water it would take to fill these 6 stone jars. And the jars were used as part of our Jewish washing ceremonies. At mealtimes, our utensils and our hands, all the way up to the elbow, needed to be washed to make us pure before God before we could eat our food. And this is what the water in these jars were used for, this cleaning. But no matter how often these ceremonies were repeated, they didn't really make us pure before God. Yeah, they might have made us a bit cleaner on the outside, but we all knew it was only skin deep. All the washing actually did was remind us of just how impure we were, how much deeper washing we really needed, especially in comparison to the perfection of God. And again and again and again, the servants went and drew this fresh water and poured it into the jars. It took a long time to pour this much water. There was certainly a lot of purification possible, and religious ceremony once all these jars were full. But I still didn't see how being prepared for religious service had anything to do with the problem of the wine running out. What were they doing? But you never guess at all what Jesus did next. He told the servants to draw a cup of water from one of these jars and take it to the chief caterer. Imagine royalty coming to your wedding and asking for another glass of wine, and instead being given a cup of dishwater. My heart sank to the pit of my stomach. This is it. This is when the game was up. This is when the moment that I'd feared all along was about to be upon me. Surely everyone would now know the disgrace. Everyone would now know that we didn't have enough wine, that we were all done, that I was inadequate in preparing and for my wedding and getting life ready for my wife. This was it. But you should have seen the reaction in his face. It was as if he was drinking the best water that he'd ever had in his whole life. Next thing I know, he was summoning me over. And he said to me, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." I was so confused. I was getting a headache, and it wasn't from drinking too much wine. What was going on? What had happened to the water? The servants had filled up the jars, scooped out a cup, and had given it to him, and he was saying that it was the best wine he'd ever had. I'd watched it all happen myself, and I still didn't understand what had happened. And not only had this one cup of dishwater turned into wine, but all of the water in all of the jars had changed as well. As much as 750 litres of dishwater were now 750 litres of the best wine ever. There was certainly enough for the rest of the guests, for the rest of the celebration. And it wasn't just enough wine, but it was fantastic wine. It was the best wine. What do you do with someone who has the power to do that kind of thing? Change water to wine. Is he about to bring something new in our country? Is he someone who can help us when the wine runs out in our lives? Years later, one of Jesus' disciples called John, wrote a biography of his life. He included how Jesus turned water into wine at my wedding as one of seven miracles and signs that give evidence that Jesus was the Son of God. Even if you're skeptical about Jesus, I'd recommend that you pick it up and read it for yourself. Consider the people Jesus spoke to. See the impact he had in their lives and how he radically changed it. And look at their responses to him. John wrote down in his gospel even more details than I have shared with you today. For example, when the wine first ran out, John recorded the precise words that Jesus said to Mary when Mary went and told Jesus. He said, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." What does it mean that Jesus' hour has not yet come? When will Jesus' hour be? What will happen when it comes? If turning water into wine isn't the pinnacle of what Jesus can do, then what is? As I read John's biography, this theme of Jesus' hour was repeated again and again and again. And every time it was as if it hasn't happened yet. It's not yet. It's still to come. It's in the future. It is like John is building the anticipation that something is coming and it will be bigger than every single miracle that Jesus had done so far. And when I got to the second half of the biography, Jesus had only 1 week of his life left. And suddenly, John records that Jesus' hour has come. Jesus arrived in our capital city of Jerusalem, where he's welcomed like a king. And then Jesus says the following. Jesus says, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this very purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." philosopher from ancient Greece named Plato, he said that the measure of a man is what he does with power. The measure of a man is what he does with power. What does someone with the power to do impossible things like change water into wine do with that kind of power? Well, Jesus seems to willingly and freely give it up. He says that the time of his betrayal and death is his hour. He didn't come to seize political control through force or to impress people with magic tricks, but instead he allows himself to die and be buried in a tomb, like a seed being buried in the ground, allowing itself to die because then it bears fruit. And the fruit of the death of Jesus is a people joined to God. You see, us Jews, we have hundreds of laws and regulations that remind us how unclean we are before God, like the ceremonies around the washing from the jars before meals. But we need someone to come and clean deeper than what goes into our mouths, but what happens in our hearts. We need God to come and fix this, and this is the true wine that Jesus claims that he brings. A rich and wonderful relationship with a God who loves and a God who cares. A God who cares about the problem of evil across the whole world, but he also cares enough about me individually to help me in my wedding in a tiny village in the middle of nowhere in Israel. That is the God. A God who wants to change us from the inside out to be like him. A God willing to die to make this possible. That seems to be this new agenda of this man Jesus. And let me just conclude my story by sharing with you the reason that John gives for writing his gospel. John says this: "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Have you believed? Have you received? Is Jesus someone you turn to when the wine runs out in your life?